sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. For the past 4 weeks, I've been airing the speeches from the November 2012 9/11 conference in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was called 9/11 Revisited, Seeking the Truth. And today I'm going to bring you another one of those speeches. The conference was sponsored by the Pradhana Global Peace Foundation. And after having listened to most of the speeches myself, I have to say that this was not just another 9/11 conference. Not that there's anything wrong with 9/11 conferences, but this was a much more powerful event. The former president of Malaysia was part of the organizing committee, and there were 30-plus ambassadors from a variety of countries in the audience. And the planners and speakers were very serious about forming some kind of an inquiry that could have some clout. And as they pointed out, much of the evidence has already been documented by independent researchers across the world. The key now is to bring it to public awareness when the corporately owned propaganda media won't. So I encourage you to listen to these speeches. History is being made in them. And with your knowledge and support, perhaps this goal of an international inquiry could be successful. This is no small matter. And so today, I'm going to share with you the speech given by Dr. Hans Kochler of the University of Innsbruck on November 19, 2012, in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. He talks about the consequences of 9/11 and how it changed the world, and that if we want to end the current madness the world has been subjected to in the wake of 9/11 and falsely justified by 9/11, that first people must understand the truth of what really happened that day. So here he is, Dr. Hans Kochler.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I will speak about 9/11, hubris of power, and the geopolitics of war. That is my provisional title for this presentation, and I hope that I manage with the time given to us. First of all, one may describe the consequences of the 9/11 events for global order in a factual manner, which I'll do in a moment. However, in order to properly understand them, we have to pay attention to developments that preceded those events. So I see a connection or a relation between this aspect of post-September 11th analysis and pre-September 11th analysis. Let's just recall very briefly. In the years following 1989, and a reference has been made by the chairman, we have witnessed the collapse of the bipolar balance of power. This event or this development was heralded as dawn of a so-called New World Order, and we recall in that regard the triumphalist speech of President George Bush Sr. after the end of major military operations against Iraq in the spring of 1991. The new geopolitical strategy at that historical moment in 91 apparently was, on the part of the US, to preserve the hegemonial position it had obtained and to eternalize this new unipolar power constellation after the collapse of, unexpected by most, collapse of the socialist bloc. The events of the year 2001 have, in the most dramatic fashion possible, I would say, provided an opportunity for this new hegemonial power to demand obedience from all in a kind of self-proclaimed global endeavor, which was presented to us, to the international public, as fight against evil. And the motto at that time was spoken by George Bush, the son, you are either with us or against us. Tertium non datur. There is no other, no third possibility. A fitting narrative was produced with almost lightning speed after, or in the course even, of that day, September 11th, 2001. Although, of course, that narrative was, as we have been told this morning, rather absurd and totally irrational. I think this would be the events of this day and how they have been covered and how they have been presented to the world public and how the world public reacted, that would really be a case study for, I would say, the biggest mass psychological event since the era of World War II. The UN Security Council was brought along within days, and it issued a kind of general authorization for the use of force. And eventually, and I cannot go into the details here, it was also, I mean, the Council was also subscribing to the U.S. narrative. And as far as I can see, the pressure to conform at the collective and individual levels was never as strong in recent history as it was in that particular constellation. A critical analysis, or if one wants to use a modern term in philosophy, a deconstruction of this official narrative is therefore absolutely essential if one wants to understand the consequences of the events more than 10 years ago. And that is the reason why it is so important that one insists on the creation of, or that one insists on an independent and impartial investigation. Also in view, by the way, of the almost total failure of the mainstream media in their role as so-called fourth estate. Let me now come quickly to the consequences, medium and long term, in regard to the global political constellation, because that is the main focus of this afternoon session. And I will mention four or five aspects, and I hope I manage with the time. First, an aspect in terms of psychology, or one could also say the climate of international relations in general. What we have seen, or what we have witnessed, and some speakers referred to it in the morning, is a kind of entrenchment of an enemy stereotype vis-a-vis Muslims or Islam as a religion. And this kind of entrenchment of that stereotype has made it very difficult for many, including even decision makers at the highest level I have spoken to in Western Europe, has made it so difficult for them to relate to the Muslim world in a rational and objective manner. The climate of international relations has been poisoned, one could say, in that regard. And we should not be surprised that psychologically it is very difficult for an individual to overcome the irrational fear that goes with that stereotype. This fear is also being exploited, as we have seen in the meantime, not only in the US, also in other countries, for purposes of domestic politics. One could also say, as far as the Muslim world is concerned, that it has been the victim of a kind of collective character assassination, while the rest of the world, and in particular the Western world, is, one could say, hostage of a self-inflicted prejudice. So this fog of suspicion is somehow over world affairs, and it has rather substantially changed also the way in which international affairs are conducted. Second aspect, very quickly. I mean, the fact is that the bipolarity of the Cold War era has been transformed into a unipolar constellation at the beginning of the 1990s, a unipolar constellation in terms of political and military power. But at the same time now, and this is the aspects in terms of relations between civilizations and their impact on geopolitics, at the same time, a new kind of global bipolarity has been shaping up, which is parallel, which relates to the relations between civilizations. And one could say that the clash of civilizations, people began to speak about at the end of the Cold War, has really been made a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And I do recall a discussion I had here in private with Samuel Huntington, I mean here in this city in Kuala Lumpur, in the middle of the 1990s, about the implications of this paradigm of the clash of civilizations. And he was certainly much more optimistic than I was at that time. Unfortunately, my concerns finally have proven to be having been a little more accurate. Third aspect in this review of the consequences relates to what I would call perpetual war, because that is what the so-called global war on terror means. As a result of these events in 2001, a kind of a situation of fear and shock has been created among the general population, and this has been exploited, and references have been made here earlier, for military expeditions and particularly for interventions in the Muslim world, Afghanistan and Iraq and so on, in order to ensure permanent control over one of the most important and sensitive geopolitical regions. And I shall not go here into details. Wars have been conducted and are still being conducted under false pretexts, as in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq, and wars are being conducted nowadays with this flavor of a crusade, although, as Prime Minister Dr. Mahathir said, President Bush has been reminded that he should, for tactical reasons, not use that term in his official speeches. Fourth aspect relates to the international rule of law. What we have seen, and I think this is quite obvious and nothing special, is the most serious erosion of the international rule of law since, I would say, the fascist era in the last century. What do I mean by that? As far as the ban on the use of force is concerned, which is one of the basic principles of modern international law, this ban on the use of force is now being completely neglected by reference, constantly being neglected by reference to the events of 9/11. And of course, this only works because of the false narrative that is given for these events. And just to give a rough list very quickly, what I mean is the Afghanistan invasion, which began in 2001, the Iraq war in 2003, more recently the Libya war, last year in 2011, but in addition to that, all practices which in an earlier era would have been considered totally unacceptable, like the so-called extrajudicial killings, which means assassination attacks by means of remotely controlled planes in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and so on. Also, one has to list here the torture of so-called terror suspects, which also has become now a kind of routine procedure, the secret renditions of supposed terror suspects, not only undertaken, I mean mainly undertaken by the United States, but in collusion and with the cooperation of some of the major allies, also including not only client states somewhere outside of Europe, but also including some of the long-standing member states of the North Atlantic Treaty. And what one should also not overlook here in this context are the fake judicial procedures which are conducted under the title or have been initiated under the name of the military tribunals. All these acts are, strictly speaking, international crimes according to the treaties and instruments of today's body of international law. And all these acts reveal what I would call the arbitrariness of power, or more generally, of course, a state of international lawlessness. And it should not surprise us that this has, as far as the international system is concerned, a kind of demoralizing effect on the community of states. How can one expect other states to abide by the rules of the law if the most powerful actor himself acts illegally? In that regard, it's a real irony that just a few weeks ago, around the middle of September, the United Nations General Assembly held a special so-called high-level meeting on the rule of law at UN headquarters. I think this is a mission impossible for the United Nations General Assembly to try to uphold the international rule of law under these circumstances. Fifth aspect I briefly want to deal with relates specifically to the United Nations organization as the universal international institution, intergovernmental body. First of all, the UN, in my assessment, as a result of these developments, is being made increasingly dysfunctional. Its authority is constantly being undermined by the unilateral action of the most powerful member state. Examples of this trend, just in a telegraphic style now, to be brief, the use of the Security Council as a kind of legitimizing tool for wars that are effectively coalition wars, such as those expeditions against Afghanistan, Iraq, and most recently, Libya. So what I mean is effectively unilateral uses of force are being, or the United Nations is used, we can say it like this, to legitimize uses of force which are effectively unilateral, but in the guise of multilateral structures. Further on, the instrumentalization of the United Nations Security Council for an elusive and perpetual global war on terror. The role of the Security Council is, for instance, evident in this new role which the Security Council has assumed, very strangely, as a kind of ad hoc court for terror suspects and the organizations which are related to those terror suspects. And what I mean here is how the so-called 1267 Committee of the Security Council operates. And the fact is that the Council acts as prosecutor, judge, and executor at the same time. This is total arbitrariness and a total contradiction to the principles of the rule of law, which requires a division of powers. And all of that is done by way of totally secretive procedures with the use of information that is provided essentially by intelligence services of interested states. And one could therefore say that the United Nations organization in this way, if it is being used in such a way, and that's the reality, the United Nations organization, in spite of the noble efforts of the General Assembly's president, undermines the very rule of law it is supposed to uphold. And as a systemic consequence, one could mention here that the ban on the threat and use of force, I mean Article 2, Paragraph 3 of the UN Charter, is being made ineffective. And one must have no illusions. The provisions of Chapter 7 of the Charter concerning the enforcement of the basic principles and of the ban on the use of force, these provisions have no deterrent effect vis-à-vis a veto-wielding member state that is able to operate outside the balance of power anyway. And this means that a new approach is taking gradually hold in the UN system, namely that of anything goes in the name of the war on terror. And this also means that whatever is being done in the name of this battle is being forgiven and is not being scrutinized. And what we see here is a kind of de facto reintroduction of the old jus ad bellum, the law to wage war, which we thought we had already overcome and abolished and abrogated forever. And that brings me to my concluding remarks, namely that it is only too obvious that these events of 2001 have brought about a sea change in international affairs, and that they have had a lasting negative impact in terms of the global power constellation. In fact, we have seen a kind of regression towards an earlier era of international anarchy, such as it existed in the 19th century power politics, with the arbitrary rule by whoever is the most powerful actor. And as I said initially, the pressure to conform collectively, also as far as state behavior is concerned, has never been greater since the era of European fascism. And one could also speak here of a kind of, mention here a kind of what I would call Machiavellian blueprint for world order, built on disinformation and resulting from it, of course, fear that in turn is meant to produce obedience. And those who challenge this strategy are becoming targets of psychological warfare. So there will be a campaign of disinformation aimed at those who dare to question the implausible and intrinsically false narrative. And we should not be surprised that most people fear, for that reason, even to ask the right question. And they fear, as I have seen so often in many discussions also with people in political positions, they fear to use their own intellect because they try to avoid by all means that label of conspiracy theorist. So we really have arrived in this Orwellian world of mind control. Just two final points concerning power and the geopolitics of war in this new constellation. First, regarding the dynamics of power, what I would say as someone who tries to analyze the situation in terms of philosophy is that what characterizes power is always that insatiable drive or urge for an increase in that very power and control over others, and per se such a tendency is opposed to what we call a balance of power. That means it is opposed to the sharing of power with other competitors. And that leads me to the second aspect in that regard, namely the psychology of power and this aspect of hubris, which I mentioned initially. An unexpectedly achieved advantage, and I mean by this the sudden disappearance of the adversary, the Soviet Union, the socialist bloc, the beginning of the 90s, is misinterpreted as a sign of one's own strength. And that leads to a kind of megalomaniac attitude, and that is somehow connected with the temptation to eternalize this advantageous position. And that's the mindset within which one would then begin to speak about one's state as the indispensable nation, and so on. So what we see nowadays is a renaissance of a geopolitics of war, where the use of armed force is reintroduced as an extension of politics, that means as a legitimate means to advance the so-called national interest, according to the famous dictum, one could say, of the 19th century German strategist von Clausewitz. And just to recall it in the English version, war is merely the continuation of policy by other means. That is the dictum of von Clausewitz. It is to be hoped that this legacy of 9/11 will ultimately be challenged by the real international community, not by the self-styled one, namely the US and her allies. And by this real international community, I mean the peoples who the UN Charter refers to in its preamble as those who are determined to build peace through human rights and justice, not through fear, subjugation, and war. In the post-September 11th constellation, the geopolitics of war has to be challenged by A, confronting the global hegemon with truth. That means by establishing a truthful record of the events on that fateful day about which we speak here, and B, by concerted action of civil society in the Muslim and Western worlds in particular, to re-establish mutual trust, which is not possible without the knowledge of truth. I'm aware that this is an enormous undertaking that requires courage of political leaders and an unwavering commitment to justice and cooperative action on the part of all the members of our global civil society. And I wish the Perdana Global Peace Foundation all the success in that noble effort, in that noble undertaking. Thank you for your attention.
And again, you've just been listening to a speech given by Dr. Hans Kochler of the University of Innsbruck at the 9/11 conference in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, at the end of November 2012. To see the videos of the speeches from the conference, you can go to YouTube and search for Kuala Lumpur and 9/11. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.